Welcome to this session of the Futures Forum, and I need to begin with an apology. One of our invited guests, Indigenous chef Clayton Donovan, has been invited to do some important work with the Indian government on issues to do with Indigenous food there and here, and he sends his apologies. However, we are very grateful to have the company of John Newton, freelance writer, journalist and novelist, who's written a number of books about food and eating, including most recently The Oldest Foods on Earth,
splendid book,
A History of Australian Native Foods with Recipes, published in 2016 by New South Publishing. It's this most recent book that makes John such an appropriate guest for this forum. Our interest today is first of all in how our Indigenous ancestors lived off our land, and how a better understanding of their food choices could help us today, but probably more importantly also about what our lack of connection to our Indigenous foods says about our overall lack of connection to our Indigenous history. John, I know you and Clayton have talked a lot about this, and we're all very much looking forward to your insights today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Charles. And let me begin by acknowledging the custodians of the land that we meet on today, the Gadigal people, and to offer my respects to their elders past and present, and to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people here today. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land. And also thank Charles and the Futures Foundation for inviting me to speak. Now, American food historian Waverley Root asserted that food is a function of the soil, for which reason every country has the food naturally fit for it. Every country, that is, except Australia. And by Australian food, I mean the plants, fruits and animals that have grown here and sustained the Indigenous people of the land for well over 50,000 years. If we eat only the food we, the first settlers and all those who followed, brought with them, can we call ourselves Australian? The British who invaded and took possession of this land for their monarchy arrived with an intact culture which included their culinary culture. They brought with them the fruit, vegetables and livestock from their home. From the outset, they imposed that food and food culture on their new land and its original inhabitants. And as we have seen, and on its original inhabitants, to their detriment. They ignored their sage, intricate management of the environment, a management that created their worldview. In his book, The Biggest Estate on Earth, Bill Gammage argues that for the Indigenous Australians, the Indigenous people of this land, theology is fused with ecology. And they overlaid an alien system of agriculture, which began the process of ecological imbalance in which the continent now finds itself, and began exporting back to Europe the European foodstuffs they planted and raised. And for around 150 years, they adhered to the diet of the first settlers. In short, European Australians lived on and not in this continent. What we eat to this day is the most material evidence of the distinction between where we are and who we are. Between where we are and who we are. And the successive waves of migrant arrivals since 1945 also brought their cultures and foods with them. And what did Anglo-Australia do? We ate them up. We embraced the food of migrants more than just about any country in the world. The result is that Australia is not just multicultural, it's multiculinary. Australians will go to a Thai restaurant, any kind of restaurant, and have no fear. They'll happily eat boat noodle soup with beef blood stirred through it, or stinking tofu, but not kangaroo or kwandongs or a kujira, bush tomatoes. Now, as the television scientist Julius Sumner Miller would have asked, why is this so? To answer that question, I think we must first acknowledge that food is far more than a material substance which is ingested and excreted. It distinguishes and defines us to ourselves and to our fellows. It can be a primary cultural marker of our clan, tribe, religion, region, province, personal sensibilities and country of origin. Based on that understanding of the complexity of food, I'd like to suggest three interconnected answers to the question that Professor Sumner Miller would have asked. Firstly, cultural determinism, which basically means you stick with what you grew up with. It made sense for the First Fleet to bring its own food to this distant, unknown land, especially when, after his brief trip up the east coast of the country in 1770, when he claimed the land for the Crown, James Cook wrote in his journal that the new territories produced hardly anything fit for man to eat. But not, perhaps, to ignore the local foods for over 250 years. The second reason, neophobia, the fear of new foods, a concept introduced by psychologist Paul Rozin. And new they were. Giant marsupials that bounded across the landscape, limes shaped like fingers, flower nardou made from a fern, large white tree grubs, strange grub indeed. Curiously, that neophobia had disappeared when we began to eat the food that the waves of migrants brought here after 1945. But that is another story. We still stubbornly rejected native foods. Finally, the dark underlying reasons for long rejection of our native foods, what I and others have called food racism. The association of these foods with the original inhabitants. This is a very hard thing to prove, very hard charge to prove, but in writing about this topic, over time, I have recorded several examples, anecdotal evidence. Perhaps the most powerful was relayed to me by Raymond Kirsch, who was a chef at Edna's Table, the Edna's Table series of restaurants. When Ray began using in Australian native produce ingredients in his dishes at the first Edna's Table, he didn't list them on the menu. But when the restaurant moved in 93 to the MLC Centre, he began listing the native ingredients used in the dishes on the menu. A good customer, who had eaten Kirsch's food in the first Edna's Table, came to the new restaurant, read the menu, went up to the chef and asked, "What are you using this Abbo shit for?" This was not an isolated instance. Now, that was something that horrified me when I was told it, but it also made me fascinated because it does show how powerful food is, how powerful a cultural pointer food is. And then something happened in 2010, something unforeseen. A Danish chef called René Redzepi, the winner of the world's best restaurant title for that year, arrived in Sydney. He extolled the virtues of foraging. During a speech at the Sydney Opera House to open the Sydney Food Festival, he explained his cuisine. "We are rediscovering," he says, "our region gastronomically." In an off-the-cuff remarks, he admitted to being puzzled at the lack of native ingredients in the menus he had encountered here. And that was in 2010. Much had changed in attitudes to Indigenous Australians, especially amongst younger people. And what Redzepi said resonated with a group of young Australian chefs, too young to carry the racial baggage of the 20th century. And chefs like Ben Shuri in Melbourne, Jacques Onfrillo in Adelaide, Peter Gilmore and Kylie Kwong in Sydney began using native ingredients in their dishes. But let's go back to the result of René Redzepi's remarks at the Opera House. At great expense and with financial assistance from the Tourism Authority, Australia, I think the Australian Tourism Authority brought him out here, the Australian ATO, I think it's called, ATA, Redzepi moved his staff and their families to Australia for a very short season of cooking using our native foods. So here we have a Danish cook, several times nominated as the best chef in the world by an English food magazine, sponsored by an Italian mineral water company, setting up shop by Sydney Harbour in a new precinct named for no good reason after the female companion, Barangaroo, of an indigenous man, Bennelong, who had been taken prisoner by Governor Phillip. This new precinct, to be dominated by a monstrous hotel which will house a casino dedicated to serving the needs of high rollers, mostly obscenely wealthy Asian gamblers, if he can pull it off. There seems to be some doubt over that now. Now, while I applauded Redzepi's remarks about our neglected foods, I have to ask, what has a $500 a head meal, $700 with wine, got to do with the food of this land? Why did seats at the table sell out anecdotally in 4 minutes? Why? Who are those seated at those tables, and what do they know or care about what they're eating? You might ask, does it matter? I think it does. And much later, in fact, I only read this yesterday, Redzepi has set up a restaurant in Mexico. And Pete Wells, writing in the New York Times, wrote a story which is headed, "Why I'm Not Reviewing Noma, Mexico." Mr. Wells nailed it when he wrote, "Can a restaurant really be of its place if it doesn't bend and sway to the breezes of local tastes and local demands? I doubt it." I ate my first kangaroo in 1993 at a restaurant called Oasis Syros in Mwalara. The chef was Philip Searle, and the recipe in the book is a wonderful dish. I'm somewhat ashamed to admit that was the first time I'd eaten roux, and maybe the only other indigenous food I'd eaten before were macadamia nuts. And I probably didn't know they were indigenous, because they weren't called Jindili, Bumbara or Bopal, some of the indigenous names for them. They were named after the friend of a scientist. Now, in the 80s and 90s, pioneer native produce chefs like Jean-Paul Brunetto, Raymond Kirsch and Andrew Felke opened restaurants serving dishes incorporating native Australian ingredients. And while visitors to the country, especially visitors to the country, and a small number of local diners supported them, the critics generally ignored or even derided them as tourist food. All the first wave restaurants closed. Now, according to John Lefleen in The Australian, who was reviewing the Noma, Australia, the Noma in Sydney, before coming to Australia, Red Zepi had asked himself a profound question. What if the Europeans and the indigenous people of this land had lived in complete harmony from the very beginning? What would a restaurant look like today? And assuming that by look like he meant more than the tables and the chairs, then I really don't think it would look like two dishes from his menu: raw marron with magpie goose ragu and a barbecued milk skin dumpling, or abalone schnitz, and I think schnitz is a schnitzel, served with bunya nuts, finger limes, sea grape and matrush. Those are the two of the dishes, only two of the dishes on Red Zepi's menu. And then you begin to ask yourself, or at least I did, what on earth does the imprimatur of a Danish chef have to do with our coming to terms with the foods of the land? A Danish chef serving excessively complex dishes at $500 a head to people who, after such a meal, obsessively documented on their smartphones but otherwise intellectually undigested, will move on to the next big thing. Because the kind of food Rezepi was serving is designed to appeal to those I call foodists, those whose attitude to food and cooking is dictated to them by fashion and the media. Rezepi's come and gone, and very little has changed. Some restaurants, sure, especially high-end ones, are serving native ingredients, and some people like your partner, Charles, is using them.
Yeah.
But it's still almost impossible to buy these ingredients in our food shops or supermarkets. If we are to get these wonderful foods, and wonderful they are, both in taste and levels of nutrients, not just into the restaurant kitchens, but into the Australian diet, then I'm afraid it's going to take a long time, because we've ignored them for a long time. How do we go about it? It's going to be a little bit more difficult than simply chucking another roux in the barbie. First, we've lost 230 years of cultivation. Europeans arrived on this island continent in 1788, and for the next 230 years, virtually ignored the food that had sustained the original inhabitants for over 50,000 years. That means those foods have not been developed, cultivated, or substantially categorised. Then we have to deal with the produce, what I've called translation gastronomy. And a good friend of mine, the aforementioned Jean-Paul Brunetto, a Frenchman and a pioneer in the use of Australian native produce, who, when he got here at the age of 12, said, "I did what a Frenchman would do. I looked around and said, what is there to eat?" And that's what he did, and that's where he found it. He said Aboriginal people did not cook barramundi with lemon myrtle butter. They just did not do that. So we have to take these foods and weave them into our culinary consciousness, not just as novelty foods or tourist foods or clever Dick chef foods, but on the shopping list and menus ordinary chefs at home cooks. Finally, and this is the most important part of the process of becoming Australian, we have to work together with the Aboriginal people on this process, as indeed we should work together on all matters involving this land. We have been ignoring the foods of the land for as long as we have been ignoring the people. We have to work with the original custodians of the land in developing these foods. We can't just do as we have done and are to a great extent still doing, just take over. We have to learn in all aspects of the relationship to walk together. Wonderful phrase. That is black and white Australians working with each other, learning from each other, walking together. It's a simple concept, but we don't seem to be able to grasp it. I think there's a conference going on at the moment amongst Indigenous Australians where they're trying to work out how to be a bit more involved in the whole process. But sidestepping the complex legal and administrative aspects of developing the native food market, what can we do about this reluctance to eat the foods native to this country, without which I contend we cannot truly call ourselves Australians? Now, here is where I make a modest proposal, which sadly reveals yet another set of problems and my own shortcomings. At the end of this book, The Oldest Foods on Earth, I naively suggested that we celebrate on Australia Day January 26th in our cities and towns with a meal of native Australian and European foods shared between European and Aboriginal Australians. The idea to give thanks to the Indigenous inhabitants for caring for the country for over 50,000 years and admittedly belatedly showing us the foods of the land. And by sitting down and eating together, begin the process of crossing the bridge that separates black and white Australia even today. It will be an act of culinary reconciliation. If you like, a reconciliation feast. Now the problem is that the date that I suggested, January 26th, is the day in which began the European takeover of this land and the denial of existence of the Indigenous people, the cruel and absurd doctrine of terra nullius as it came to be known. Understandably, the descendants of the original inhabitants are not very happy about celebrating such a day. In fact, every January 26th I march with them on Invasion Day March. How could I have suggested that? Because I was just a white fella doing what white fellas have always done. I then thought a better day would be Mabo Day, which falls on June the 3rd and commemorates a historic decision by the High Court of Australia in 1992 by which the assumption that Australia had been an empty land, terra nullius, was overturned. But it was then pointed out to me this would meet with strong opposition from many European Australians. Finally, I thought, OK, how about we hold the feast, if we can get it up, the Reconciliation Feast on May the 27th, which is the date of the referendum in 1967, when Australians voted overwhelmingly to amend the Constitution to include Aboriginal people in the census and allow the Commonwealth to create laws for them. Now, interrupt slightly, I don't know whether you read The Weekend Australian. Did you read the Nicholas Rothwell story? Well, strongly recommend it. A very long story, which sets out the pitfalls and problems and, you know, of this conference and of the possibility of there being a change in the Constitution, which is going on right now. It's going to be fascinating and it doesn't look very helpful because we changed a lot since 1967. Yeah. This forum is being held under the auspices of the Future Foundation. The difficulty that this simple proposal has had illustrates how profoundly the actions and inactions of the past affect the future. But whether or not we manage to find a way to hold such a reconciliation feast, and I hope we do, non-Indigenous Australians must accept that the original inhabitants have carefully stewarded this land for the entire time they lived here and have the oldest unbroken culture in the world. Before racism, culinary and otherwise, will disappear. As Bruce Pascoe writes in his book, Dark Emu, we have said sorry, now we must say thanks. At the end of The Biggest Estate on Earth, which is a wonderful book and I urge you to read, Bill Gummidge writes, "We have a continent to learn. If we are to survive, let alone feel at home, we must begin to understand our country. If we succeed, one day we might become Australian." And I ask, can we really be Australian if we ignore the food of the land? And I still maintain that one way of achieving this may well be to sit down as brothers and sisters and share a meal. Thank you.
Yeah, excellent.